Yeah, you know,
hit it with full, full flow.
The internet's audible hotspot.
Yeah.
Pro Flow for Show Show. Wireless phone interview feature presentation.
Pro Flow for Show Show. Pro Flow for Show Show. Pro Flow for Show Show.
Check this out.
Excuse me. This is a parental advisory. If you don't want your child listening to adult content, you might want to shut this off. We're keeping it clean now. We're keeping it clean, but it's still some adult content. You can't just say everything. Feel me? Don't go nowhere. Mad Max over and out.
www.maxheat.com. Proflowradio.com.
Hello?
Hey, Mr. Mash. What should I call you, sir?
You can call me Lou Marklin.
Hi, so Lou, thank you, of course, first for being on the show. If you can tell the audience where you're from and if you don't mind giving them a place they can find you on the internet.
Sure. Thanks, Max. My name is Lou Marklin, and I'm from Los Angeles, California. And I can be found just about anywhere. If you just type in Lou Marklin anywhere on the internet, you'll find tons of different places to read up on me and stuff like that. I do have a couple of different websites. If you go to iconnews.us, you can find us on the internet. I'll add that we are the first television show, national television show, that has adopted the .us extension. And that, there's a lot of story behind that. Part of that story is it was the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 tribute, and we decided to change from .com to .us to commemorate the movement, not only of national, you know, just the national collective, but also to remind us that in these times of recession that we have to support each other, you know, tearing down, you know, everything from racism to just, you know, people that are taking advantage of third world countries and everything else. You know, it was kind of a place that we came to where we thought, you know, this is a time when we can all reflect and we can all, you know, look at what's going on, and we can remind ourselves that, you know, we have to rally and become a village, you know. And that was kind of our theme last year, is being a village that helps raise each other, including our kids, which is what got me involved with Malia and Pat and them.
Okay. Now, yes, Malia did help me to get this interview lined up, and I do appreciate it. Now, how long have you known Malia?
Oh, she's such a sweetheart, and I've only known Malia just a short year, and
really?
She's just such a wonderful, wonderful person.
Yeah, her goodness works fast, that's for sure, and it works hard.
It does.
Now, when I was reading about your history and how you became the person that you are, Lou Marklin, I read that you started out doing, you know, just rap as a, what was it, 14? Or was it younger than that?
I was about 10. Yeah, I was 10 when I first started rapping. And, yeah, I was just a kid. I was in sixth grade, and some friends of mine got together, and we decided that we were going to, you know, enter this talent show. We grew up in one of the neighborhoods in L.A. where breakdancing was kind of originated in that part of L.A. Shabadoo was our idol, and he lived about a block from us. So we used to run down to the schoolyard and listen to Houdini and Run DMC, you know, on our boom boxes, and Shabadoo would go out there, and Fred, and they'd bring out the Whirlpool boxes and breakdance, and I just, man, we thought that was the greatest thing that had ever come to town. The only problem is that I was the fat kid in the bunch, and so I couldn't dance, man.
I understand that.
So I started writing, you know, you gotta just kind of do what you're able to.
yes, that's the truth, Now, was that the start of your music career?
Yeah, that was the beginning of my music career. And, you know, I was, you know, like I said, I was 10 years old, so I was just in sixth grade. And we started performing for school things. And then about a year later, we got in the studio for the first time when we were about 11.
Okay.
And I started a record company in the ninth grade called Project Records. And We pressed our first vinyl records, and you know, at the time NWA had, you know, just blown up, and they were about 10 miles from us, and that was the talk of the town. I mean, our friends were showing up at school in junior high, and they had tapes, you know, those little red cassette tapes that had Dr. Dre's first, you know, cuts of Boys in the Hood and, you know, Dope Man and stuff, and we were just like, wow, oh my God, you know, we was like the golden grail. And so we thought, man, we're going to start our own record company and be just like Ruthless Records, and we're going to press our own vinyl. And we went to this company called Alsha Records in Burbank, and we, you know, we had them press up vinyl and went all over the country and performed and went to radio stations, and it was a lot of fun. I mean, it was really back when rap music just had the whole world ahead of it. You know, anything went, because nobody had really laid the foundation so far, and, you know, it was every year there was something new coming out. It was like blowing our minds, you know.
Was it? Do you feel that it was easy? It sounds so easy. Or were you just good at it?
I think in a lot of ways it was just there was so much excitement in the air, and there was definitely a certain talent that was there. But then I also have to say that because it was such a new music form, everyone was so forgiving of when we would mess up, because there really wasn't like this long history yet. So, you know, it was kind of like, okay, you know, these guys rap all right, you know, they're gonna get better, but you know, but at the same time, you know, it was, you know, nowadays these kids that are rapping blow my mind completely. I mean, these kids got talent that just oozes out of their pores. I just saw a 10-year-old kid the other day, he was 10 or 11 years old, and he was sitting in front of his computer, and a friend of mine sent me his video, and he turns around and he's making beats and turning around rapping to him right after the beat's made, and I'm like, oh man, what are these kids coming from?
That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean,
that's amazing.
But the competition now is so much different. You know, there's just so many ways to make music now, and so many people doing it that, you know, I mean, gosh, when I was doing it, I was probably only maybe one of five white rappers in the whole country. I mean, there was Everlast and, you know, the Beastie Boys, and that was it. You know,
man,
it was like
right.
A novelty, but, you know, shoot.
Yeah, it's definitely changed the game, that's for sure. You're one of the pioneers,
yeah,
you can say, basically. This was all in California, you said, right?
Yeah, yeah. I was a big fan of the New York rap scene, though. I mean, really, a lot of the rap was from New York, and we were just getting on the bandwagon. I mean, Ice-T was just a puppy back then. I mean, we were talking about 1984. And so, you know, back then the big thing was, you know, the Fat Boys and Run DMC, and they were the first ones to ever come on the big screen. And when Tougher Than Leather came out, we were like, holy crap, it's on the movie screen. And, you know, Crush Groove and stuff like that, you know. And yeah, it was a lot, the New York style really influenced us, especially when, you know, Eric B. and Rakim came out and guys like that, you know. It was a whole new thing. You know, the music videos were you know, like little mini movies, kind of following the Michael Jackson, you know, kind of style. I mean, you had Rakim that was, you know, dressed like the mafia mobster and running around doing the follow the leader thing, and, you know, and stuff like that. And yeah, that was pretty cool.
Definitely. Now, but did you go to college for TV, basically?
Yeah, I went to college. That was only about 2002 that I went back to college for television. You know, I was kind of a troubled youth, you know, when I was a kid, and I got in a lot of trouble. I was kicked out of all my schools, and by the time I was in high school, I got kicked out of my high schools, and, you know, and I only went to ninth grade, actually. And I went to a Bible college, of all things, when I was 19 or 20. And I got into the ministry for about 4.5 years and did a lot of evangelism and stuff. And then I didn't go back to school until I was about 28. I was doing my music stuff, and I originally went back to school thinking I would, you know, chase down my music career again. But I was working at Saban Entertainment, and I was working where they make the Power Rangers, and that kind of changed, derailed me to a different direction. I was working at Fox Family and Saban, and after about 2 years of that, I decided I'd go back to school and learn television. And that was kind of where I changed and decided to go in a whole different direction.
Now, working for these companies, big companies, you know, that changed your life like that, was this something that, you know, you just, because you're in the area, you just happen to find a job at a company like that? Is that how it works out there? I'm not really sure. You know, I'm from Ohio here, you know?
No, it's really funny, actually. It's a very unlikely story. I moved back down to Los Angeles after a few years of going up, heading to Northern California. Decided I wanted to be back in the music industry, and I didn't know where to start, what to do, or anything. And I got down there, and I was looking through, you know, newspaper listings and everything else. You know, everything that I called, you know, they needed some kind of college education or some kind of a background. And I thought, God, this is an uphill battle. And, you know, I finally decided I was just gonna just draw from my street smarts, do whatever I could. And I went to a security company, and I took a security exam to get a guard card. And I told them, I said, hey, you know what, because they place you in different security companies in the city, these different security companies. And I said, hey, what do you guys have that's an entertainment company? I don't care what it is, you know, just, you know, do you guys have some kind of an account that does security for an entertainment company? And they said, yeah, we got this one and that one over here. And, you know, and they said, let's just go to this one place. And I had no idea what this place was, man. They just said, you know, Saban Entertainment. I don't know what the hell Saban Entertainment is. You know, I showed up and I'm at this big high riser, and, you know, and it's a beautiful building with all these people everywhere. And I'm like, you know, the first week or two, I was just in awe. I'm like, oh my God, like, this is crazy. I'm making like minimum wage. But I couldn't believe it, you know, and everybody in there was just like me. We were all making minimum wage, but we all had aspirations. One guy's a writer, another guy was a stand-up comedian, and, you know, and I was the rapper guy, and, you know, I was drawing cartoons, thinking maybe I could get in as a cartoon artist. And the Arabian Prince from NWA was working there as an artist, and, you know, and they made the Power Rangers there, so I got a healthy dose of Power Rangers. My kids got Power Rangers for like three Christmases in a row, and I forced them to watch the cartoon because they were like, "What's this, right, Dad?" I said, "Well, you know what? Don't worry about it. Just start watching it, because you're gonna get a lot of these over the next 3 years."
Yeah.
Like that.
Definitely.
Yeah. So just. You know, it was kind of funny because me and my girlfriend actually slept in my car, and they had a parking structure there at the company, and so we started sleeping in our car at the parking structure at the actual company. So I'd get out of work at night, and I would just walk up to the parking structure, and we would sleep next to the car, and people started noticing that we were sleeping in our car, and they were like, "Hey, man, is that you sleeping in your car?" I was like, "Yeah, man, you know, I just, you know, I'm doing what I gotta do," and so it actually opened some doors for me, because people were like, really? "Wow, this guy's really, he's hardcore, man. He's sleeping in the garage up there, you know."
So with that in mind, you just laugh all these things off, man. It's just so crazy. I don't know. I've caught so many lessons already. Been talking to you within about 15 minutes here now. I got to get you to give some advice to the people listening, because, you know, so far we haven't even gotten to your TV experience yet. You've already had all these different ups and downs and working this way and that way. You know, what advice would you give to people that are striving in the music business, or just, you know, striving in life and struggling in life?
Man, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind is, you know, just the pursuit of happiness. You know, I tell people all the time, man, pursue happiness relentlessly, and never forget that you are an artist and you make yourself an artist. Nobody makes you an artist. You're an artist in your own right before anybody ever gives you a record contract or gives you a job. You know, you just have to, you know, become your own artist. You know, you know, it sounds funny, but, you know, Lady Gaga said it really well recently. She said, you know, a record contract doesn't make a recording artist. A recording artist makes himself. You know, and you just gotta just believe in your art, believe in who you are, be creative, and, you know, and, you know, do whatever you have to do to get there. You know, always be looking for, you know, for that hole in the fence. You know, I remember as a kid sitting in Montana, I was traveling around the country performing and doing music, and went to this one ranch where they let us stay for a few days, and I went out there fishing, and I watched the cows all day, and they just walk in circles, relentlessly walking in circles, just looking for a hole in the fence. And I just thought to myself, God, these cows, man, like all day long, they're walking in a circle, they're looking for a hole in the fence, and it's like if you just open up a little hole, those cows will get through the damn fence, man. And I thought, you know, life is like that, man. You just got to keep on going around that circle, looking for the hole in the fence, and you know, the opportunity comes, that little hole, you know, it ends up, you find that snag, that hole in the fence, and then you slip through and you get to the next level. And you know, it's kind of like playing a video game, you know, you get to that next level and then you just, you know, play a little harder, you know.
Yeah, man. Oh, man. Whew. Man. Okay. Let's keep rolling. Let's see. So far we've covered the start of the career, the music career, which was rapping at the young age, and
yeah.
Now we're sleeping in cars at the major companies, you know, really dedicated. People see that you are really dedicated and they want to assist, so you can open some doors up. Now, is this where TV comes in?
Yeah, so I, at that point, I had been there at Saban at Fox Family for about 2.5 years, and, you know, just being immersed in it, I kind of got a new confidence about where I was at, and I was seeing the day-to-day activity around me. I had the unique opportunity of going from floor to floor. It was a 24-story high-rise, and as a security guard, you know, you kind of work your way up, and then they make you what they call a rover guard, and we just start roving from floor to floor. So I would meet people that were on the art floor, and then I'd meet people that were in the recording studio floor, and I'd meet people that were on the television writing floor, and the artist floor, and some of the, you know, comic book artists and stuff like that. And then I got up to the top floors in the 22nd, 23rd, 24th, and hung out with the actual owners of the company, you know, Haim Saban, right, and Shuki Levy and guys like that. And, you know, and as I started hanging out with these guys and the presidents and vice presidents, I started realizing, you know, these guys are just like me, man. They're just, you know, hardworking guys. They, you know, they're friendly. You know, you walk by at 7 o'clock at night, they're still in their office, they're still working. I started seeing the work ethic, you know, that they possessed, and I started realizing, like, you know, man, this is what I got to be if I want to be this guy. This is what I got to, you know, act like. This is how I got to, you know, kind of approach this thing. And, you know, I always feel like you find somebody who's really successful, who also embodies the kind of personality and the way that, you know, the way about them that you want to be when you get older, and you kind of emulate them, and you kind of follow their path, you know, so to speak. And you know, you see the certain things, the qualities about them that kind of makes them who they are. And there was a couple guys that I kind of, you know, singled out and just kind of, you know, watched them walk their walk, you know, and, you know, started coming in their office at 6-7 o'clock at night and just kind of, you know, shooting the breeze with them and asking them questions. And, you know, it's amazing how, you know, sometimes it's a pleasant break in somebody's long night, you know, to answer a bunch of questions from, you know, a young guy who's kind of, you know, trying to find his way. Got lucky that they were real nice guys and they actually answered the question.
Yeah, that's true too. I understand that. One of the things that stood out to me about your history was that one major thing was I'm going to go with the media ministry. The term just kind of stuck out to me because you know, and there was another statement that you spoke that was mentioned about keeping the industry in check. Now, you mentioned family factions. Now, if you don't mind, just maybe elaborating on those ideas.
Sure. I was real lucky about in my career is I got a chance to be around a lot of family programming and family kind of entertainment companies. Even starting with Fox Family, it was all family programming, Saturday morning cartoons, Saturday morning programming, and there's a certain kind of attitude that and an air that kind of follows in a place like that. You didn't see a lot of people, you know, cursing in the hallways. You didn't see, you know, I never saw anybody blow up or, you know, to lose their mind. You know, it was a very healthy atmosphere. You know, the people that I worked around were all people that were married and had kids and stuff like that. And when I moved on, I went back into LA after going to college, and I worked for, you know, the Los Angeles Dodgers. And ironically, the guy who I got hired by, who was the director there, was actually one of the vice presidents at Saban, who had met me several years before when I was still on my little struggle, you know, to get up. And so he actually recognized me before I recognized him, and so he hired me. And when I came in, it was that same kind of atmosphere of, you know, family-oriented, you know, work ethics, you know, with working with the Dodgers. It's a very tight-knit organization, and the people that work, you know, in the organization, you know, there's a real strict, you know, no drugs and no drinking policies. You know, everyone has to kind of be on their best at all times and stuff like that. And so it really, it kind of honed me, and it showed me a different side of the industry that was a little bit different than some of the things that I had learned earlier as a rap artist. You know, I mean, being a rapper, it was, you know, it's kind of developed into a party, you know, partying all the time and drugs. And, you know, I had done my share of drugs and stuff, and so seeing this other side of the coin was really good for me, because what it showed me is that, okay, as you're getting older, as you're growing up, you can actually kind of you know, kind of taper off and start being responsible and you know, and see this other side where all these people are, you know, just good family people that are, you know, doing this business. And you know, there tends to be a stigma in Hollywood where people think that everyone is like Lindsay Lohan, or, you know, everyone's like, you know, Heath Ledger, you know, and it's really not true. There's this whole subculture in Hollywood that's, you know, really just, you know, really just down to earth and good family kind of programming. And I realized that there's a ton of money involved, you know, working with guys like Frank McCourt and Haim Saban. I mean, these guys are billionaires, and they, you know, have done it on these family ethics. And you know, I began to realize that there's something really important and powerful about that. And I've always had a passion for, you know, working with charities and stuff like that. And so it slowly started to take over, you know, my thinking on just a lot of different fronts. You know, how much better this country would be if everybody had a positive message, how much better, you know, our world, you know, peace movement would be, how much better leaders could get along with each other if we had somebody putting everyone in check, how much, you know, I remember just seeing kids who were, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old, you know, going to a friend's house, and they're cussing, and they're, you know, doing all these crazy things, and they're listening to, you know, Snoop Dogg and, you know, all this other stuff. And, you know, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, and the problem I started noticing is that, like, even when they do like a remix album, you know, the Kmart version or the Walmart version, you know, their idea of cleaning up the CD is just take out the bad words or put a bleep, you know, bleep there, or a funny word that sounds like a bad word. And I thought, that's not really, you know, I mean, yeah, it's nicer because there's no cuss words, but really I'd rather have the cuss words than the message, you know, and the message is... You know, telling my kid that smoking weed is okay, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, they didn't change an idea.
He got the upgrade,
you
know? But he still told him to take more drugs.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't make sense how they try to manipulate and then think it's okay. I agree with that.
Right.
I definitely stand against the negative lyrics in the music industry, because it's definitely running rampant. It's crazy right now.
Yeah, it's crazy. And, you know, working, and even now, I mean, I, you know, we're doing a project that's just in about 2 or 3 weeks, and there's several rappers, Wu-Tang Clan and some different, you know, big rap artists, and NoID, and Snoop Dogg's actually part of it. And, you know, when I say these messages, I'm not putting down Snoop or any of these artists just saying, hey, you know, let's keep this thing in check, and
right,
you know, yeah, you know, let's you know, how about, you know, start telling people that this album right here is not for anybody under 18, or, you know, just be straight with it. Just say, hey, I'm going to lose a bunch of money right now, but I really don't think anybody under 18 needs to hear this message when they're too young to decipher the difference between, you know, what's an adult, you know, theme and what's a kid theme, you know, because what happens is, you know, if one of these artists, they tell these kids that are 8 years old or 9 years old that all life is about, like that new song they have out, you know, all life's about is smoking out and, you know, getting high. Well, that kid doesn't have the, you know, he may not have parents at home, and so he goes out and he starts smoking weed and he's listening to Snoop Dogg and he's thinking that that's the way things are. And then what's Snoop Dogg going to say when he walks up to him at 40 years old and says, hey, I just got out of prison for 15 years because I was smoking weed every day and got popped and then got in trouble and then ended up robbing somebody. And, you know, I mean, there's a point where, you know, there's some accountability there where you just, you can't give that guy his 15 years back, you know?
Yeah, you're right, man. I mean,
It's unfortunate. This is the world is very right. Well, it's just weak right now. That's for sure. But like you say, you need people to stand up in numbers to have a positive message, so that there is a guard against people slipping through the cracks. That's for sure. I don't know. I don't want to sound crazy or defeated, but it's just very hard out here now because these negative lyrics have really taken over, it seems like. But
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I know you're in Ohio, and I was just over there in Cincinnati this last year, and man, you know, it's got to feel like a defeated feeling with the Bengals dropping out like that last year.
Ohio tees, man. Alone, Ohio tees are, let's not even talk about the Browns, you know what I mean? We love our Cleveland
teams, man.
But, I'm not buying a ticket, I know that. But I wanted to ask you more about your TV. The TV shows that were produced that were produced solely out of your account and out of your endeavors that were very received very well. The ratings were stronger than some of the national networks that were producing shows at the same time. Like, I'm sure that had to be a great experience, as well as a very stressful or at least a lot of work experience, you know. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, I started producing ADHD TV in 2007, and at the time I was working at ABC News, and I decided that I wanted to, you know, my dream was to produce a national television show, and my ultimate dream still is, you know, and at the time was to host like a late night show, you know, like a Ooh. Jay Leno type show or something like that. Yeah, that'd be great.
That would be crazy.
That's the golden grail right there.
Man, that would be great.
And so, you know, I was working at a local station, and, you know, there's always politics and everything that you do, and working at a local station, you know, you certainly, it was a better job than, you know, than I could ever complain about. But I could see that, you know, there's, to a certain extent, you know, it wasn't going to satisfy me for, you know, for the rest of my life, and, you know, it was going to keep me from doing what I wanted to do. So I decided that I would kind of, you know, throw my dice on the table and just kind of, you know, go after my dream. I didn't have a lot of money though, and so I had to get creative. And I'm actually I just finished writing my book about this. It's going to come out on the 31st, and
really?
It's called TV and TV and ADHD is what it's called, and it really talks about all of these issues. How I basically had no money in my pocket. I had to look around, get resourceful, and find a format that I could produce on my own that we could syndicate.
Really?
And wow. Oh yeah, it was a lot of fun, man. It was
pretty
so much fun. And yeah, and it was just our creativity, you know, just us having fun, just doing what we could. And it was that same exact model that we used as kids when we started our record company, and we did it, you know, out of the back of the car. You know, it was the same exact thing, but with television, you know. And I realized that, you know, that history repeats itself, and I was going to take that same exact model and apply it to television. It was kind of an uncharted territory, you know.
Wow. That's amazing, man.
It was amazing. We actually started it on public, you know, public television. We, you know, mostly public access stations, you know, and we started shooting the show, and, you know, we started sending it out to several stations at a time, and then eventually got some commercial stations that picked it up, and, you know, we decided to start casting the show, and we got a bunch of actors from Hollywood to come up and join the show, and the momentum just kept picking up, and yeah, it was really amazing. And the next thing you know, we've got this whole cast of characters. We had reporters and, you know, and actors, and we shot the whole thing in a green screen. So we had Saturday Night Live or in living color or mixed with a green screen, so we didn't have to have a big studio. And, you know, it was really what I call the poor man's special effect, you know. And a lot of people don't realize, you know, back in 1984, the Empire Strikes Back film was the first big movie in modern Hollywood to utilize green screen on a large scale like that. But 1930, I believe it was 1936, was the first film that used green screen. And it was like the country was coming out of a recession. A lot of movie companies got flushed out during the Depression, and they had to have some form of a cheap, cheap alternative to filming these expensive movies. And I thought to myself, well, I'm just that guy. I'm a guy with no money in his pocket trying to make a TV show. He has a tiny, tiny little space to turn into a studio. I'm going to use a green screen, and I'm going to turn this into my, I'm going to, go all over the world in this green screen, We found backgrounds and backdrops that made the look and the feel of the show very surreal. So it kind of took the viewer inside of this strange space. So, because we kind of knew that, green screen was our level of green screen use was going to be obvious to the viewer. So we didn't want to try to like act like we were being serious. We wanted to purposely make the whole thing into a joke, And so it was like all the backgrounds were these weird looking backgrounds that are just surreal. A courtroom that looked, we wanted the viewer to, kind of have a little bit of a mind trip watching it. And so, and part of the first year or so the show was on, it was really a lot of the responses we got from a lot of viewers was, man, when you're inebriated and you watch that show, you feel like you're having an acid trip on alcohol, because wow. The show was so out there, it was moving, it was really fast. The show, it just moved from one skit to the next. It was a lot faster than Saturday Night Live, which I kind of felt like, coming from the MTV generation, we had to move a lot faster. I know that this generation's got even a shorter attention span than ours did, so I knew that we needed to move quick, because I'll watch Saturday Night Live, and by the time they're done with the skit, I'm starting to yawn, because I'm like, man, it's right. 5-minute skit, 6-minute skit, get it on, get it quick, get it moving. We did that, and it was great, and we were nominated for a couple of Emmys, in 2009 at the end of the show, and that was just exciting, man. We went down to San Diego and met with the Emmys committee, and there was a big Emmys ceremony, and we got to, hang out and be there, and we were the only public produced television show in the history of the Southwest, regional Emmys, and that was just an honor to be a part of, and
man,
yeah, I still got the invitation hanging on my wall, and I look at it all the time, and it reminds me that, people can tell you that something can't be done, but there's always an exception to every rule,
Man, you got that right. I believe in that 100%.
Yeah, we have the book. The book is out. It's going to be out on the 31st. We actually have a big event that we're going to be launching the book at, and that's in Beverly Hills at the Beverly Hills Country Club. We've got numerous celebrities that are going to be there for the launch of the book. There's too many to list, but we've got probably about 150 or 200 celebrities that will be there for the launch of the book, which is kind of an exciting thing in its own, because we went from, I went from sleeping in a car to being the water boy to being the production guy to now, being one of the peers of all these celebrities. We got Joanna Krupa and, Christina Duros is my good friend, and just a ton of people. Wow. You can find that online. And we'll be launching that book, and it really will share and tell people, how they can start their show the way that we did and nationally syndicate a show, and it's just, I think it's really going to help a lot of people. It also deals with other issues. I had a substance abuse problem, and so I address that in the book a little bit, and, I talk a little bit about my battle with drugs and alcohol. Mostly alcohol, and then I also talk about some of the funny things that happened on set, and some of the crazy things that happened with the actors, and some of the battles and fights that we had and stuff like that. And we did have a crazy group. We had a bunch of guys that were recovering alcoholics and drug addicts mixed in with a bunch of current alcohol and drug addicts, and they were all going back and forth, and there was guns on set, and it was everything you can imagine. It was just nuts, and people that watch the show, on the show, we had a lot of skits where we had a little music video that was really infamous, where we kind of remade Sarah Palin the first month after she got announced as a vice president candidate, and we made this music video with one of the actresses who was Sarah Palin. There's all these guns and stuff, and a lot of people didn't realize that those were all real guns, and it was kind of funny.
Wow.
But yeah, we have stuff about about that, and then we have a new show out that's called Icon News, and that's kind of my baby right now. And Icon News is we talk to a lot of the biggest celebrities of today, and we ask them questions about, you know, what you're asking me today. Just, you know, what did they overcome to get to where they are? You know, what is their unique story, and you know, what are the trials that they faced, and what did they do, and what kind of mentality did they have to draw from in order to overcome those things. And the second half of the show is about causes and charity work, and we're really, really passionate about that. Really, I think that probably 50-70% of my life right now is about charities and organizations, and I have this huge passion for so many different charities. Make-A-Wish Foundation, we just put up a bunch of videos for PETA this last weekend, and you know, just Habitat for Humanity, Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic, of course, you know, Muse Art and Conscious Music Entertainment. And so what we do is we ask a lot of celebrities to tell us about their charitable work and their life of service. And it's amazing what has happened, you know, over the course of the show, just, you know, talking to different celebrities. You know, and when you ask them that question, you start to find out what they're really about. And I've heard some stories that have just, you know, just been amazing. You know, Cassandra Hepburn was one of the stories that I haven't released yet, that I'm looking forward to releasing, just because it's so amazing. And she,
yes,
you know, she gave up 3.5 years of her career to go to Hades after the Haiti disasters, and she worked with Red Cross to save people and to help people. And I just was amazed, you know, because here she had just been in the Grindhouse movie, and
right,
you know, her career was all of a sudden blossoming. And right when it was blossoming, she just, you know, jumped on a plane,
right,
headed out to Hades, and said, "Hey, I'm not coming back until this thing is cleaned up." And I just,
right,
had such an immense respect for her, you know, as she told me this. And I'm just thinking, you know, because everywhere I looked in the media, when I was looking up, you know, questions to ask her for her interview, the only,
yeah,
thing I could find was stories about, you know, how sexy she was in this, how she took,
right,
her clothes off in that. And I'm thinking, this, you know, this is junk, you know, like this, you know, this person just gave up 3 years of their life to go to Hades, and nobody's even mentioned a sentence of it in the press, you know.
From,
and
Grindhouse,
so I really, yeah, and I just really felt like, you know, and then when she came back, she, you know, was co-star in Surfer Dude, you know, with Matthew McConaughey and,
yeah,
you know, and stuff. And I think it'll really blow a lot of people's minds when they hear her tell the story, because I think it'll put her in a different light. And so, yeah, Icon News is out, and you can see clips of that on YouTube if you just go to YouTube and type in Icon News, and that'll pull up a bunch of stuff on that. Then I just, you know, I've also been working on some music stuff, and
okay,
I haven't released anything for about a year, so I still do that, though. It's not really my main focus, but I do like to dabble with it, and it really is what I do to relieve my my mind and stuff. And I just signed a contract with a... yeah, I produced some different things. I signed a contract about a month ago with a company out of Palm Springs that does a lot of movie and soundtrack stuff, and I'll be making I'm looking forward to that, just making beats and, you know, and stuff like that. And then I'm working on an album concept right now. It's a hip-hop album, and it's different. It's a little different than the stuff I've done in the past, and it's what I call adult contemporary hip-hop. And it's going to be all kind of laid back, you know, music that's about life, about just pondering, just, you know, just things about, you know, getting older and finding wisdom and just, you know, yeah, some laid back stuff, you know, and it's kind of Dido mixed with hip hop, you know.
Kinda, yeah, I got that idea.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be nice. That'd
yeah.
Be real smooth.
Yeah,
real,
I think it'll be fun.
Cool, man.
Real smooth, yeah.
My name is Mad Max, and I approve this message. If you or anyone else you know would like to have their poetry, music featured on the Pro Flow for Show Show, check us out, www.maxi.com. It's Pro Flow Radio.